Hello there, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Audacious Aotearoa. This is your host, Christopher Carroll. Great to have you with us. Today, I am going to be interviewing Douglas Atkinson, who's a postdoctoral university assistant at the University of Salzburg in Austria. And his line of research uses game theory to understand wars like the one playing out between Ukraine and Russia at the moment. We look at costs, bargaining, and their role within the international system to understand how things might progress going forward for the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. All right, Douglas, welcome to Audacious Aotearoa. It's great to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me.
In your article you co-authored for The Conversation recently, you talk about bargaining having a key role in the lead-up to war. How does bargaining play out on the international stage in a range of different ways? And does bargaining always entail war?
Okay, so this is a very good question. So bargaining, the way to think about this, so we have borrowed this model from game theory within international relations. And what we do is we simplify this very complex world, and we're looking at it from a bargaining approach. And the key to bargaining is that there's some kind of disagreement over an issue, right? How do we distribute an issue? So the bargaining goes on over a range of issues, from things from big to small. The more salient the issue, the harder it is to come to some kind of agreement over it, because the more the actors care about it, the less salient the issue, the less the actors are going to care about it, and the more easy it is going to, they are going to be able to divide it. And so when countries are bargaining, they're going to make their decisions theoretically based upon their probability of winning some kind of hypothetical war, right? And so the war is always in the background in this framework, right? So it's kind of like a Kenneth Waltz, like, you know, in a state of anarchy, right? There's no one to actually enforce these things. So war is always in the background, but ideally the countries want to avoid war because war is really costly, right? And so they would end up paying more for the goods than they would if they avoided war, if they went to war. So their preferred outcome is they can somehow come to an agreement over how to divide it without going to war. But sometimes that's not possible, right? So there's three different reasons why this doesn't happen inside of this framework. One is there's an information problem. So they can't come to agreement over who is going to win this hypothetical war, their probabilities of winning the hypothetical war. The second is a commitment problem. So they can't come to, they don't believe each other that the one side is going to stick with the agreement that they've made, because they anticipate like a huge shift in power. So like the way to think about it is like, you know, the robber comes up to you with a gun, right? And they have this gun and they say, give me your money and you have to promise not to tell the police, right? And I won't shoot you. Well, as soon as they take the gun away from you, there's this shift in power, right? And you can go and tell the police. So that commitment to not call the police is incredible. So the same thing happens in international relations. When there's these shifts in power, right, the commitment is incredible. And the other is indivisible issues. So these are things that are difficult to divide. And so when one of those three things is introduced into the bargaining framework, they have a hard time coming to an agreement over the distribution of the issue.
And so the issue isn't necessarily trade related, right? It could be territory. It could be security, a dilemma. How does it range in terms of looking at bargaining on different issues?
One of the things that I've personally done in my work is looking at a broad range of issues. So in a lot of models that game theorists use to model war, they're usually looking at territory. But countries fight over a lot of different kinds of issues. So these can be ranging from things from like ideological unification, which is what North Vietnam was fighting over, to compensation for some kind of past wrong, to things like trade, like you were talking about. How do we distribute who is getting what portion of trade? policies that one country is implemented that another country doesn't like, to their treatment of ethnic minorities. So there's just a broad range of issues that are being fought over. And these specific issues, they introduce their own problems into this bargaining dynamic.
So honing in on this now and looking at the example of Ukraine, there's a number of potential explanations in the lead up to a conflict like this provided by parties on either side of the conflict. And then there's also assumptions being made before the conflict begins. How might this play out, and how important is information connected to both the start of a conflict and how it's currently playing out between Ukraine and Russia?
Yeah, so I think in the lead up to this, there was a lot of miscalculations on both sides, right? So there's two pieces of vital information you need to know in order to split things up, to decide what the probability of the hypothetical war was going to be. And that is the both sides' willingness to fight, and then their military capabilities. So both sides had really accurate information on the other side's military capabilities. They knew that Russia was much more powerful. But there wasn't accurate information about, for both sides, on the willingness to fight. So there's been stories that Putin anticipated very low levels of resistance, that the government would fall relatively quickly, and that the people would be pretty welcoming. What he's found instead is this really, really strong desire to fight, right? It was a complete miscalculation. And if he would have known that, it might have changed his calculations going up into fighting the war. And the same is true for Ukraine, right? They didn't anticipate that Putin had this willingness to fight. Putin and the Russian decision makers had this willingness to fight that they did, right? So there was this complete miscalculation about the willingness to fight. You know, you heard stories about Ukraine not still being surprised by the invasion only a couple of, the potential for the invasion only a couple of days before the war. So there were miscalculations on both sides.
So there's a shift occurring in the sense of, normally we'd look at international relations, if we're looking at it through this game theory lens, as a number of different bargainings that are taking place.
So in the bargaining model, right, the issue that led to the war is going to be resolved by the war. And that is at the point where the war will end, right? So the information problem that was introduced because they miscalculated each other's willingness to fight is really difficult to resolve, right? Because that's private information. And because that's private, so it's like something that you keep to yourself, right? No one can actually see it. And it can only be revealed by you actually suffering up to that point. Because anytime you try to tell somebody how much you're willing to suffer, they're going to say, well, that person's lying, right? They just want a better deal. So in this case, there's this like intense dynamic. And how is that resolved? Well, it's resolved by attrition style warfare, which you get this like intense rivalry with like the emotional dynamics of that rivalry that are feeding into that willingness to suffer, right? And so it's just compounding this problem, and the willingness to suffer keeps increasing as the issues become ever more salient, right, to the Ukrainian people and to the Russians themselves, right? So it seems that Vladimir Putin is also doubling down, right? This is becoming more to him than it was at the beginning.
What do you think events on the ground in Ukraine at the moment tell us about the realizations being made by both sides, and how the conflict is going to unfold going forward? And what do you think the Russian and Ukrainian leadership have had to change about their thinking because of the way that the conflict is unfolding?
Yeah, I think events on the ground are unfolding in a way that is terrifying for the loss of human life, right? We're seeing this transition into attrition warfare from what they thought was going to be a quick victory. They've moved into attrition warfare. And the idea behind attrition warfare, right, is that there's a cost that somebody's willing to pay for whatever you're fighting over. So there's some cost that the Ukrainians are willing to pay to hold on to Ukraine, and there's some cost that the Russians are willing to pay to capture Ukraine, and they're going to push each other until one side just gives up. And these wars have a tendency to drag on for a very long time. They cause immense human suffering. And I think that the realization that this is going to be a long protracted struggle is starting, and it's going to have to involve attrition style warfare, has changed, especially Russian calculations with them bombing civilians at an increased rate, just trying to increase the costs along the way, right? So it's not necessarily about defeating the military, it's about increasing the costs until some point the Ukrainians give up. And I think that realization was made, you know, sometime fairly early in the war, a couple of weeks in, Vladimir Putin realized, right, there's not going to be a quick military defeat. These people are going to fight till the bitter end. And the only way to win that war is through this really intense attrition style warfare.
And there's been a lot of talk about peace talks, and there's been a number of countries that have been diplomatically moving to set up some sort of resolution, right? But then there's also a school of thought that you've indicated to already that suggests that war will end when the conflict, you know, that started the war is resolved on the battlefield. What does this tell us about these diplomatic efforts and whether they are likely to lead to some sort of peaceful resolution?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully, I mean, we can all hope that this is what happens, but just looking at the issues that they're fighting over, the salience of those issues, and the size of the problem that they had, right? So this information problem and their inability to communicate to each other how far they're willing to go suggests they can't come to a realistic probability of who's going to win, right? Nobody knows who's going to win this. You know, at the beginning of the war, our estimates in the Western countries were that this was going to be relatively quick, right? That they could put up some resistance, but it was going to be a couple of days or weeks. But now there's a real chance, some probability, some unknown probability that Ukraine could win, right? And that Russia will give up. But we don't know where that is. And if they don't know where that is, it's going to be really hard to come to some kind of agreement. Because if Ukraine can win, they don't have to concede all of their autonomy like Putin is asking for to make defense decisions. I'm not optimistic about their chances of coming to any kind of resolution relatively quickly. Hopefully I'm wrong and they can come to some kind of agreement. The thing I think that we don't know, because Russia, you know, this kind of goes into domestic politics, and this plays very heavily into this kind of thinking. We don't know is Russian politics. It's very opaque, right? What kind of pressure are they putting on Putin to come to an agreement? And that's something that we would need to know, because that would calculate, you know, in this attrition style warfare, who is experiencing the costs, and their ability to pressure the leader is something that we need to know for when, you know, they might be close to wanting to give up and accept to something short of what they were hoping for.
Yeah, right. So this line of research almost looks at war as though it's political. I'm curious if you can explain, and you've almost done this already looking at it through a lens of game theory, but I'm wondering how this line of research connects to with you know, historical wars, and how this kind of thinking can be applied across a range of different conflicts.
Okay. So I think, you know, like in the academic tradition, this kind of thinking goes back to Clausewitz, who said that war is just an extension of politics. It just takes on a different form, right? It's policy in a different form. And this idea is that things are fundamentally political, right? So like wars in the past, have all been about fundamentally political objectives, right? They can't come to some kind of peaceful agreement. And so because they're fundamentally political, politics are suffused in all of this, right? So we can't separate what's happening on the battlefield from the politics at home and the politics internationally. All of this is what's happening on the battlefield is what we can see, but those costs that are being imposed on the battlefield and then the politics behind that play in a really, really important role in how all of this is going to unfold, because the fundamental objectives are all political.
So how do efforts by other countries outside of the conflict, and by the immediate conflict, I mean what's happening in Ukraine, play into this understanding of conflict as political and a rivalry based on a breakdown of communications, trust, and bargaining? How should we understand a number of countries implementing sanctions at the moment and maneuvering that's happening there?
Yeah, so what these countries can do by implementing sanctions, and what sanctions these sanctions have done, is they impose costs indirectly on, or directly on, Putin and the Russian government, right? And so the idea is, right, if war is about politics, then war becomes about just imposing costs on your opponent, right? These costs on the opponent are part of the war, right? It's hopefully the thinking behind this is that it will hasten Putin to the negotiating table to come to some kind of agreement short of what he's asking for, because these costs are so high, and Putin might not want to go on with these high political costs because they're going to put some kind of pressure on his ability to stay in office. So this is just another means of a country imposing costs on an opponent that are not on the battlefield, but are related to the war. I guess financial warfare. And they all play into this, right? All of the costs, no matter where they're coming from, are being calculated by the decision makers.
What do you think is the likely time frame for this conflict? You've alluded to this answer already, but again, I'm curious. I want to press you more on it. Do you see it as playing out long term, or do you see a resolution made either through the fighting or through talks that entails peace?
I think the salience of the issues would suggest that both sides, or especially the Ukrainians, their willingness to suffer is extremely high. I don't see a way out for Putin, right? There's a lot of academic research that shows that authoritarian governments have a hard time stepping down because they usually leave office and they go into a prison cell or to a box if they lose, or in a coffin if they lose a war. And so because of this, and because the issues just are so salient, I don't see there being a way for them to come to some kind of agreement anytime soon. Now, I hope that I'm wrong. And because their willingness is so high, I don't see either side achieving some kind of decisive military victory. And so I can see this going on for quite a while. I'm hesitant to like give an exact time frame, but these things take a long time, right? If we look at historical wars, they take a long time to play out. There's immense amounts of human suffering. People can go on far longer than you think they would be able to in war when these really salient issues are on the table. And so, yeah, I would say quite a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering too, it's almost the elephant in the room that I cannot not talk about. How does COVID kind of change the way that you'd think about a conflict, given the lens that you're applying in this case of game theory and bargaining and costs? How does COVID almost throw a curveball in the mix, if at all?
I think one of the things that has done, right, is it weakened everyone almost universally, right? And the degree to which it weakened people is somewhat unknown. So it added a lot of uncertainty into the international arena, which could explain a lot about like why we are seeing this increase in threats and aggression in the international system. But directly on the fighting on the battlefield, I mean, I'm not necessarily qualified to talk about that. And I guess it would be if there was a high level of COVID contagion because of the fighting, it would just be an additional cost. But I'm not sure if it would play too large of a role in the outcome of the war at this point.
Yeah, I think my angle with that, just thinking about it, was reflecting on what you were saying earlier about authoritarian regimes and how situations like this create a box for them. But COVID's almost creating a dilemma further for Putin, in the sense that there's talk of, you know, almost the need for him to bolster support in Russia for himself, because of the breakdown that Russia's experienced in their management of COVID.
Yeah, I think, I mean, all of this is, I mean, Putin's kind of revealed himself as a really poor manager of government, which we didn't necessarily know before. And I think all of this is just, you know, costs on top of costs. And there's, at some point, there's some breaking point. I don't know where that is, right? But the problem that we have with Russia, right? So every country, right? So the academic research, selectorate theory. So the idea is that every country, you know, has a selectorate. So it's a group of people that keep somebody in power, right? So in democracies, right, this is going to be relatively large. And the more authoritarian a regime becomes, the smaller the size of this selectorate, right? And so this selectorate in Russia is relatively small. And so the people that can directly take him out of office, that have the means and the power to do that, is a relatively small group of people. The everyday person, they don't have a direct access to do that, right? They don't have any direct means of choosing a leader. What they could do if the costs become high enough, right, would be a revolution, but the costs of engaging in any kind of behavior that even comes close to approaching that are really high, right? So you know, there's 15-year prison sentences for people who speak out against the war. So the costs of the war and then the costs of COVID would have to be so high that people are willing to risk that. They say, my life is so bad anyway, I'm willing to risk whatever punishment you have in store for me, right? Whereas like the more direct route is costs put directly onto the people keeping him in power, which is the oligarchs and the Russian mafia and whoever else is in Putin's direct orbit, right? Which is what the Western powers are trying to do with their sanctions.
Yeah. Yeah, see, I mean, I think the really interesting offshoot of this research is that it's too easy, I think, at times to look at things through a realist lens when it comes to conflicts like this, particularly when you're focusing on costs. But what you've said just there actually makes me think there's a great little tie-in as well with constructivist thinking, where you're actually focused on individual actors and you're not rewriting human nature in what you're saying, but rather you're trying to impose a reality on what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the things is, you know, this is getting into the weeds of academia, but a lot of people who take this rational approach have started to incorporate, they realize like, you know, there's costs come in a lot of different forms and value comes in a lot of different forms. So like, for example, in my own research, I look at intangible value. How does that affect bargaining dynamics? Right. So things that you can't touch and feel, right? So things like democracy that you might value a lot. So those kind of things are being incorporated a lot more. And then the idea of costs, I mean, there can be like psychological costs, there can be physical, and you know, it's just, it's not all monetary. And so we've kind of shifted away from thinking like that, right? And incorporating a lot of constructivist ideas. I mean, there's a lot of constructivist ideas in my own research, just because it more closely approaches reality.
Yeah, that's cool. Hey, Douglas, thank you so much. It's been great to have a chat with you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me. Anytime.